So welcome everyone to the second week of our five-week series on a portrait of Jesus. Last week, we got our foot in the door. We laid an introduction and we started with John chapter 1. We learned that Jesus was baptized in AD 29 on the Jewish feast of Passover in the Jordan River opposite Jericho. He was then driven by the Holy Spirit into the wilderness where he was tempted 40 days. He then came back to Jericho, and we meet him in Jericho in John chapter 1 at verse 19, where John the Baptist is baptizing at the Jewish feast of Pentecost, which comes 50 days after Passover, and Jesus is on the fringe of the crowd. And we noticed, as we studied through John chapter 1, that Jesus met his disciples there in Jerusalem. He met Peter, Andrew, James, John, Philip, Nathanael. He met them in Jerusalem at the festival, and then they all walked back together to Galilee, a three-day journey, we learned. So they have had time together. And by the time we get to chapter 2 at verse 12, after the wedding at Cana, oh, they spent a whole week having quite the party at Cana. And we read in verse 12 that after the wedding at Cana, they went down to Capernaum with his mother and brothers and his disciples, and they stayed there for a few days. And I noted that that was the after party to the wedding at Cana, and it was at Peter's home in Capernaum. Now, look at the very next verse, John 2, verse 13. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, I noted the time markers in John that move us sequentially through the narrative. Between verses 12 and 13, almost a year goes by. So we begin at Passover, AD 29. Pentecost, Jesus is on the fringe of the crowd. Then they go back to Galilee. Then they have the wedding at Cana. Then they go to Capernaum. And then it's the next Passover. How do we know that Jesus had a three-year public ministry? There are three pilgrimage cycles in the gospel according to John. Passover, Pentecost, Tabernacles, three times. Hence, a three-year public ministry. But notice, at John 2, verse 13, when it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. So he has known these fellows for a whole year. And he's not asked anything of them at this point. Tonight, we're going to begin with Jesus beginning his public ministry and traveling throughout Galilee, teaching, preaching, and healing. And that's where we start tonight. We'll get through part of Jesus' teaching tonight, primarily the Sermon on the Mount. And then next week, we'll pick up additional teaching, ending with the Transfiguration. And then we head for Jerusalem into the shadow of the cross to the crucifixion, burial, and resurrection. And that will take us through our five-week series. So, let's begin, as we do all of our classes, with prayer. Gracious Father, we thank you for bringing us here this evening to read and to study your word. Please open our minds and our hearts to what you have to say, that in better understanding you, we may come to love you more deeply. God, our Father, you sent your Son into the world to be its true light. Pour out the Holy Spirit, he promised us, to sow truth in our hearts and awaken in us obedience to the faith. May we all be born again to new life and enter the fellowship of your one holy people. Grant this through our Lord Jesus Christ, your Son, who lives and reigns with you and the Holy Spirit, one God forever and ever. Amen. I'd like to turn over to the gospel according to Luke. Luke chapter 5 at verse 1. Now remember, Jesus has been with these fellows for almost a year. He lives in Nazareth. They live in Capernaum and Bethsaida. The three cities, Nazareth to the Sea of Galilee, is about an hour's drive. It's about the distance from here to Huntington Beach. So it's not that far. Did they correspond during that time? Did they go back and forth? I can't imagine that they didn't, and I think I speculated on that last week. If you had met Jesus in Jerusalem, you had spent the entire festival with him, you had been with him privately in conversation, you fully believed that he is the Messiah, the Son of God, and then you walked all the way back to Galilee, you went to the party, the wedding at Cana, all that time, would you then allow months to go by with no contact when he's just down the 405? No, of course not. And I don't think they did either. I think there's contact along the way because, in fact, Jesus moves to Capernaum and sets up his headquarters for his public ministry in Capernaum. He will live at Peter's home in Capernaum. So we enter now in Luke chapter 5 at verse 1. Jesus is living in Capernaum. And we read, "One day as Jesus was standing by the lake of Gennesaret," that would be the Sea of Galilee. The Sea of Galilee is called the Sea of Galilee. It's called the Lake of Gennesaret because of the plain of Gennesaret right on one side of it. And it's also called the Sea of Tiberias. Tiberias is the largest city on the Sea of Galilee. So depending on your perspective, it goes by three different names, same body of water. We'll get our map up here in a little bit. We're getting our visuals going here. But technical difficulties, but we'll get through them. So he's there at the Sea of Galilee with the people crowding around him and listening to the word of God. And he saw at the water's edge two boats left there by the fishermen who were washing their nets. Now we need to pause for a moment. Jesus is teaching near the shore of the Sea of Galilee. Picture the Sea of Galilee at about 11 o'clock. If you think of it as a clock, that's where Capernaum is. If you go up the hill, there's a long sloping hillside going northwest from Capernaum, and you can walk from Capernaum up to the top of the hill in 20 minutes. And that hillside is where he would teach. It's a natural place to teach. I'll have a photo of it up here as we get the technology going. But that hillside is a very good place to teach. When I take folks to Israel, we start in Galilee. And the very first morning we're there, we go up to the top of that hill, to the Mount of Beatitudes. And we used to be able to walk down that hill to the shore of the Sea of Galilee. It's private property, it's agricultural land. And the man who owns the land put up a fence so that we couldn't do that anymore. The crazy Christians kept trampling his crops. But we used to walk down. Some of you have done that with me. And on the hillside, it's a natural kind of amphitheater. And we'd sit down. I'd go down slope a bit and talk in a normal voice. And people could hear very easily. In fact, B. Kobe Chrysler did a study of the acoustics on the hillside of the Sea of Galilee. He published it in Biblical Archaeologist in December of 1976. And the article was titled, "The Acoustics and Crowd Capacity of Natural Theaters in Palestine." And he found that the acoustics of that hillside are roughly like those of the Disney Center. They're really good. You don't need a microphone to speak to 5,000 people. It's a perfect place to do this. Now, I'm standing up front, right? I'm a good, 30 feet from the front row, and I'm 4 steps up on the platform. This, by the way, is a podium, like podiatrist. It's where you put your feet. This is a lectern. Picky English teacher stuff, but there you are. So now you know, don't make the rookie mistake of putting your book on the podium, otherwise you'll be looking down at the floor. So it's a lectern. I'm elevated, and I have distance between you and me. And that's very deliberate, because I can look out at the crowd, I can make eye contact, I can notice when people are nodding off, which means I need to ratchet things up. I can look for a response. If you're not laughing when you're supposed to, I need to do something funny. So I have audience contact, but I need the distance. If I'm way down here in the front, I can see the people in the front, but I can't see over top of them, right? So if there's a big crowd and Jesus is teaching, the crowd tends to come up on top of him. So here we are. Let me get our map here. Sea of Galilee, and we're about 11 o'clock up on the hillside. Oh, it has a pointer too. We're up on the Sea of Galilee. Where was I? Oh, and the crowd is pushing in on him. If we did not have the steps and a different flooring in the front, and you were standing, people would keep moving up. When we go on tour and I'm teaching on site, that's what people tend to do. They get real close around. He needs, with a big crowd, he needs distance to make that contact. And he's right up now on the edge of the Sea of Galilee, and the crowd's on top of him. So what's he going to do? Well, he looked around and he saw at the water's edge two boats left there by the fishermen who were washing their nets. That means they're done fishing for the day. You go fishing late, well, early morning when it's still dark. And by 10 o'clock, the boats are in, the cargo's unloaded, the nets are being washed, and everything's being put away. So the two boats are being prepared for the day for storage to go out again that night. They're washing the nets. Now, he got into one of the boats, the one belonging to Simon, that is Peter, and asked him to put out a little from shore. Now, he's not going to go up to a perfect stranger and say, "Excuse me, may I use your boat?" Get in it and say, "Oh, by the way, would you push it out a bit?" No, he knows Peter. He's living at Peter's house. He sees them finishing up the work, and he said, "Is it okay if I use the boat?" And he gets in the boat, and Peter then pushes it out and creates the distance. You're not going to come out in the water to crowd him, right? That's what he's doing, creating a little bit of distance so that he can work with the crowd. Now, out there in the boat, he sat down and taught the people from the boat. He has a perfect distance between himself and them. He sat down. Now, typically in Judaism at this time, the teacher would sit and the audience would stand. I kind of like that idea. Maybe I'll pull a chair up here, right? It's a gesture of respect to the teacher. The teacher would sit in the chair and the crowd would stand and listen to the teaching. Hence, we get, for example, the chair of St. Peter, the place from which one would teach. So he sits in the boat. And it's a real practical thing. You wouldn't stand in the boat in the water. You're liable to tip the boat when you're gesturing. So he sits in the boat and he teaches. When he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into deep water and let the nets down for a catch." Now, let me move through our slides up here for the beginning. We have, of course, our Sea of Galilee up in the north. If you go to the Sea of Galilee, here's the Sea of Galilee at sunrise. And you see in the distance, here's the lake, and you're looking eastward. You see the sun coming up over here, the sky brightening, and the mountains over here, that's the eastern mountain range, the Golan Heights. So it's quite a lovely scene when you look at it early in the morning. If you look west at about 9 o'clock on the Sea of Galilee, remember last time I said the breeze comes off the Mediterranean at around 3, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, around Mount Carmel, the little nub on the map, crosses the Jezreel Valley, narrows into the pass at the Arbel Cliff, and picks up speed, crossing the Sea of Galilee from 9 o'clock to 2 o'clock. So he's put out into deep water and let down the nets. Imagine Peter saying, "We just got in. The nets have been cleaned. We're there now." Oh, there we are. So there's the Arbel Cliff. If you're looking westward, there's the Arbel Cliff, about 700 feet above sea level. And there's the narrow pass. And the breeze comes that way. Then we move onto the water, and we're in a boat, and we're still looking at the Arbel in the distance. So there's our Sea of Galilee. Here's a fisherman casting his net. That's my friend Daniel. Daniel owns Worship Boats of Galilee. He owns two boats. He's working on a third. They're called Faith, Hope, and Love. And Daniel is the only Christian owner of a boat on the Sea of Galilee. So it's called they're called the Worship Boats of Galilee. And he's a good friend. We go with him when we go out on the Sea of Galilee in one of his boats. And he demonstrates casting a net on the Sea of Galilee. So it's quite a lovely location. Here we are now up the hill where our story is going to take place in a moment. And we're looking from about, here is 11:30, 11 o'clock on the Sea of Galilee. We've come up the hill, and we're at the top of the hill at an area called the Mount of Beatitudes. I'll get there momentarily. But I want you to have a visual image of what's going on around us. Now, put out into deep water and lower the nets. And notice how Peter responds. Master, in other words, you got to hear his tone of voice. Master, come on, we just got in. We've been up all night and everything's clean and put away. If you say so. And out they go. And they go to the northern part of the Sea of Galilee up here. Sea of Galilee, there's the very most northern point. It's 11 miles long, 7 miles wide, and the fishing all takes place up north. Because up north, it's warmer water. The upper Jordan flows in, and there are 7 hot springs underneath that flow up. So those hot springs bring many nutrients, as well as the upper Jordan, and that area is much more abundant in fish. So that's where they put out, right into the lake. And they lower the nets. And when they had done so, they caught such a large number of fish that their nets began to break. I mean, they dropped their net right on top of a gigantic school of fish. And they catch a lot of them. There are two types of fish, primarily, in the Sea of Galilee. One is carp. Well, a carp is an unclean fish. It's a scavenger. You don't eat them. If you get them in your net, you throw them back in, no matter how big they are. The other is often called St. Peter's fish. St. Peter's fish is a type of tilapia, and it's quite good. When we're at the Sea of Galilee, we make sure we stop and have St. Peter's fish. But that's primarily the fish that would be caught. And these are commercial fishermen. They're not fishing for dinner. Peter and his brother Andrew, James and his brother John, and their father Zebedee own a commercial fishing business on the Sea of Galilee. They have at least 2 boats and a crew for both, and perhaps more. So they catch so many fish that the nets are beginning to break. I mean, they caught nothing all night long, and they just drop it right on top of the school. They signal to their partners in the other boat, come help. And they came and filled both boats so full that they began to sink. I mean, they're down at the water's edge. When Peter saw this, he fell at Jesus' knees, and he said, go away from me, Lord, I'm a sinful man. Now remember, we often get the impression that Jesus simply comes up to these people and says, follow me, and they all go, okay, and off they go, leaving everything behind. No, they have known each other for almost a year. Jesus is living in Peter's house, but he's never asked him for anything. As I said last time, faith is not a blind leap in the dark. Faith is a reasoned response to God's self-revelation based upon knowledge, belief, and trust. Like any other relationship with any other person, you have to spend time with them, listen to them, talk to them, meet their friends, and get to know them. And that's exactly what these men are doing with Jesus and he with them. But now, it's time for a decision. And he asks for it. It's time for a decision, and Peter knows it. He knows that Jesus is the Messiah. They've had a year together. He knows. And he said, you got the wrong guy. I'm a fisherman. Come on. I can't do this. I can't do this. Lord, I'm a sinful man. You need somebody at a much higher pay grade than me. He and all his companions were astonished at the catch of fish. It's clearly a sign. And so were James and John, the sons of Zebedee, Simon's partners. And then Jesus said to Simon, "Don't be afraid. From now on, you will catch men." Don't be afraid. How many of us, when we get to know Christ, we spend time with him, we listen to him in his word, we talk to him in prayer, we meet his friends in the family of God, the church, and at some point in that relationship, he will say to you, "Come with me." And you have a choice to make, to reach out, take his hand, and follow him, or not. And why would you not? Because you're afraid. Because if you follow him, there are some pretty big implications to that. It will change not only your life, but your eternity. And I might not particularly like my life the way it is, but at least I know it. And I'm not up for living life on the spiritual edge. I'm afraid. And they were too. Don't be afraid. From now on, you'll catch men. So they pulled their boats up on shore, left everything, and followed him. Now they are fully committed. Now they're on the journey. And what is it they will do? Turn over with me to Matthew chapter 4, verse 23. Matthew 4, verse 23. Jesus went throughout Galilee, the territory of Galilee up north, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and sickness among the people. His public ministry consisted of three things: teaching, preaching, and healing. They're three very different things. Teaching is explication of the text. It's what we do here in our classes. We read the text, I read it to you, comment on it, and explicate it, explain it, open it up so you can see it and understand it. Explication. Teaching is explication. Preaching is application. Taking the text and applying it to your life. On Sunday at the homily, it's preaching. It's application of the readings. Tonight, Monday night, is explication of the text. Teaching and preaching. Two very different things. And I think a mistake that many people make who teach the Bible is blending the two, not seeing the distinction between the two, and blending it. And when you do that, well, it's kind of like going to church again on Sunday. And in fact, if you teach a class like that, you start out with 400 people, you end up with 20. That's the way it goes, right? Teaching and preaching are two very different skills. You can have a very good Bible teacher who is not a particularly good preacher. You can have a dynamite preacher who can't teach his way out of a paper bag. So they're two different spiritual gifts entirely. Jesus was one of the rare people who was really good at both. So teaching is explication of the text. Preaching is application of the text. And healing every disease and sickness among the people. Why did he do that? Well, obviously, he had compassion on people. He certainly did. But he heals people's illnesses. He cures a man born blind. He, talk about miracle. He raises the dead. No person can perform a miracle. No one, including Jesus himself. In fact, over in Acts chapter 2, on the Jewish Feast of Pentecost, A.D. 32, when the church is born as a covenant community under grace, And Peter stands up and preaches his sermon at Pentecost. In Acts chapter 2, right in the middle of that sermon, and it's an application of the text, right in the middle of that, as he is moving toward his grand conclusion, he says in Acts chapter 2, verse 22, "Men of Israel," and he's standing at the temple platform with 1,000 people in front of him. Only 50 days before Jesus had been crucified, buried, and raised. Only 50 days before, Peter was afraid of the servant girl in the courtyard of the high priest. Now he's standing at the temple with 1,000 people, and listen to him. "Men of Israel, listen to this. Jesus of Nazareth was a man accredited by God to you by miracles, wonders, and signs which God did among you through him." Notice, God did among you through him. In Judaism, at this time, before and after, no person can perform a miracle. Only God can perform a miracle. And if he chooses to perform that miracle through you, it suggests an implied intimacy with God. And the greater the miracle, the greater the intimacy. Thus, if I'm saying something about God and it's accompanied by some miraculous event, that's a sign to you of my closeness to God. Therefore, you better sit up and pay attention. That's the way it works. Over, and we're going to look at this next week with the healings and the miracles. But if we go back to Kings, for example, 1 Kings, we meet the great prophet Elijah. Elijah will do some, God will perform some extraordinary miracles through Elijah. For example, Elijah raises a dead child. His successor, Elisha, raises a dead child. And in both cases, the child has just died. Jesus raises a dead child, Jairus' daughter. She's 12 years old. She's just died. If you were present at that event, you would instantly flash back to Elijah and Elisha, and you would say, there's one here just like Elijah and Elisha, the great prophets in the Hebrew Scriptures. Oh, but then Jesus raises a young man, the widow of Nain's son, who has died and is about to be buried. He's even deader than the little girl. She was warm dead, he's cold dead, and he's going in the ground. He raises the widow of Nain's son. Oh, and then he raises Lazarus, who has been rotting in a tomb for 4 days. If you were a witness to these events, you would say, Elijah and Elisha, nothing. He is really close to God. We better pay attention. And that's the point of the miracles, the healings. He has compassion on people, yes, but it's a sign to the people of his authority for saying what he says and for them to believe it. Why should they believe an itinerant preacher in Galilee? There are a whole lot of itinerant preachers in Galilee. Well, this one is extraordinary. So, we're going to look tonight and focus in on his teaching, especially his teaching. Jesus' teaching falls into three categories. Expository teaching, which is taking the text of Scripture and exposing it. It's explicating the text, number one. Number two is dialectic teaching, which is argumentation. How many times does Jesus argue with the religious leaders, the Pharisees in particular? The arguing, we think, oh, that's not very polite. They keep arguing with him and questioning him. Rabbi Michael Marison, who's on my staff, a Reform rabbi, not Christian, Reform rabbi. Michael teaches a number of really good classes for Logos, one of which is the Judaism that Jesus knew and practiced. Another is Judaism at the time of Jesus and after. And a really good class is why Jews reject Jesus as the Messiah. Really good class. He can do it in 2 hours or a weekend. And he's a really good teacher. Well, he's twice as funny as Jerry Seinfeld and half the cost. So he's worth having around. But Michael said, when he reads, the New Testament and the arguing's going on. And Christians say, well, that's not very nice. They keep pushing him and arguing. And Michael said, what's the big deal? That's what we do, right? Judaism is about argumentation, putting forward a principle, arguing the principle, really pushing it to its extreme to see if the logic holds up, and eventually truth will emerge from the argument. There's no doctrine in Judaism. There's simply the give and take of dialectic. And Jesus was doing that quite often, and he's pretty darn good at it, as we'll see next week. The third category is parables. That is, telling a story. A parable is not meant to hide the truth. A parable, it's a Greek word, compound word, para, the preposition alongside, like paramedic or paralegal, and bola, the verb to throw. A parable is something, a clever, memorable story thrown alongside an old truth in a way that illuminates it in a striking and memorable fashion. And Jesus was a genius at parables. And we'll look at him closely next week. I don't think he ever made one up. I think he took them from what he's looking at. The parable of the sower, for example. He said, picture the crowd on that hillside that we're looking at. He's downslope, and he begins teaching. He looks up the slope. It's farmland today. It was then too. And he sees the farmers sowing their seed in the field. And he says, a farmer was sowing his seed. And they all turn around to look, and by golly, there's the farmer up there sowing his seed. And some of the seed fell on rocky ground. There are rocks all over the place here. Some of the seed fell on shallow soil. And he goes on with that parable. And then he explains it to them. He simply takes it from what he's looking at. Like any good teacher, if I'm going to illustrate a point, I'll take it from something that's around us that we all see, especially teaching on sight. Now, you never know what you're going to see. In fact, we were in Turkey, in the footsteps of Paul, western and eastern Turkey, and we were in Lydia's hometown. Remember Lydia, Paul's friend that he meets in Philippi? Lydia from Thyatira. Thyatira is in central Turkey. And it's a very small town, and we were there visiting the seven churches mentioned in Revelation. And at Thyatira, it's a small site, only one little city block square, completely surrounded by the modern-day city. And it's an archaeological site. And I'm there teaching from Revelation, the letter to Thyatira. And as I'm teaching, on the street, a convertible drives by. And it had cans dragging behind it, and there was a whole entourage behind it all tooting their horns, and I thought, must be a wedding. No, there was a little boy sitting in a chair painted gold, like a gold wooden chair with gold paint on it, and he had a robe on, a purple robe, and a crown. And he was a little boy, maybe 7 years old. And he was sitting up on the back, the chair was up on the back of the convertible, and he's smiling and waving to everyone. It can't be a wedding, right? What's going on? Our colleague in Turkey, Ferit, some of you know, afterward said, what was the deal with the convertible and the little boy? And he said, he's the circumcision boy. Muslims circumcise males as well. God gives circumcision to Abraham in Genesis. That's around 2000 BC. But in Egypt, they practiced circumcision 1,000 years earlier. It comes right out of Egypt. I'll tell you, everything in Judaism and Christianity, everything, has its antecedents in ancient Egypt. And we can't go there right now. Things are a little difficult. But the circumcision boy. Jews are circumcised on the 8th day after birth. Muslims are circumcised at 7 years old. I know. And Farid said, oh, it's a big deal. I remember my circumcision. And he told a whole story about it on the bus. And Well, you know what the jokes were ever after that, all the rest of the trip. But we took the illustration from what was happening there in front of us. That's what good teachers do. And Jesus is a master teacher. So he'll take these parables and develop them from things that are going on around him or things that were in the LA Times the day before, current events. So we'll see that next time. But what we're going to look at is his expository teaching. Wouldn't it be nice to have an example of it? Well, we do in Matthew chapters 5 through 7, the Sermon on the Mount. We read over in chapter 5, well, he went throughout Galilee teaching, preaching, and healing. Now, we're going to look at this teaching very carefully and very closely to see how he operates, how he teaches. But he went throughout Galilee teaching, preaching, and healing. Josephus, the historian who lived from around AD 37 to about 95, was a Jew who was a commander of the military forces in Galilee. He later surrendered to the Romans and became a Roman citizen and moved to Rome. But Josephus knew this territory of Galilee like the back of his hand. And he writes in his History of the Jewish Wars, there were 204 towns and villages in Galilee. Capernaum, on the shore, we'll see it momentarily, had maybe 1,500 people as a population. But there were these all around the shore of the Sea of Galilee were little fishing villages. Inland were villages. 204 towns and villages. Jesus went throughout Galilee teaching, preaching, and healing. He had 3 years to do it. I'll bet he visited every one of them. And if you have a really good teaching, you don't give it once, stick it in a drawer, and never do it again. You just don't. If you have a really good teaching, you use it over and over again with a variety of audiences in a variety of places for a variety of reasons. What we're doing tonight, I did the very same class last Wednesday at the University of San Diego. 2-hour class, Portrait of Jesus. Ours is 5 weeks long. The standard Portrait of Jesus, my class, is a 12-week class over an academic quarter. When Monsignor Torgerson asked if I would teach it here, we have 5 weeks during Lent. I have to compress it into 5 weeks. But I can do a Portrait of Jesus as a 12-week class, a 5-week class, a 2-hour class. I can do it as a 12-minute homily, right? You just take the material and compress it and use it the way you need to do to fit the time frame and the audience. And Jesus is really good at this. So we're going to look at a teaching that is a very good teaching, that is a memorable teaching, and see how he does it. Oh, it's going to be great. Chapter 5, verse 1. When he saw the crowds gathering, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. Well, what we're looking at is the only mountainside around. That's where he went. Up on the hillside into that natural amphitheater, and he began to teach them. This teaching that we call the Sermon on the Mount is a 4-part teaching. It has a 4-part structure. If you are giving a presentation at work in the boardroom, or if you are giving a presentation for a client, or if you are preaching a sermon or a homily, how do you do it? Rookie mistake, don't teach in a linear fashion from point A to point B with a whole lot of points along the way. Nobody can remember a linear structure. If you are teaching or doing a presentation or giving a talk, don't tell the audience everything you know. Rookie mistake. Tell the audience what they need to know to understand what you want. Teach them what they need to know, not what you know. If you're giving a presentation or teaching, you don't teach material. You teach people. The material is just a way of teaching people. What you do as a teacher is teach people, not material. So, watch how Jesus will do it. He's teaching people. He organizes his teaching into a four-part structure, and he illustrates it in ways that are memorable from stuff around him. It is really good. So if you're doing that presentation, make it, I like a five-part structure. Start out with a clever introduction, not some corny joke, but something that connects to people and they stand, sit up and take notice and go, oh, got my attention, right? A memorable introduction that's striking. Then move through three major parts of your talk, three major points that you want to make, developing each one, and then end it with a call to action. What do you want the audience to do? You don't want to leave that room until you get a commitment on what to do next, who's going to do it, and what the timeline will be. That's how you structure a presentation or a teaching or a homily, whatever. I like five parts. Four works as well. Three doesn't. Not enough material. Four part or five part? Jesus chooses four part. A four part structure. Part one, chapter 5, verses 3 through 16. 3 through 16. Title it Clever and Memorable Introduction. It's going to get their attention and it will be unforgettable. So part one is the clever and memorable introduction, chapter 5, verses 3 through 16. Part two, chapter 5, verse 17, all the way through verse 48, the end of the chapter, 17 through 48. Title it, Six Propositions That Exceed the Law. Six Propositions That Exceed the Law. Part three. Chapter 6, verse 1 through chapter 7, verse 6. So chapter 6, verse 1 through 7, verse 6. Title it, Six Concrete Actions to Implement the Law. Six Concrete Actions to Implement the Law. Then part 4, chapter 7, verse 7 through verse 27. Conclusion and call to action. He's drawing everything to a tight close, and he's saying, here's what I want you to do next. So a basic four-part structure, really easy to remember. Our brains are hardwired to remember categories, not linear time frames. So basic four-part structure. Part one is the clever and memorable introduction. If you lose them on part one, forget parts two, three, and four. Part one is really important. And notice how he begins. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Well, we've heard this so many times we don't hear it anymore. But this would have been, huh? It is profoundly counterintuitive. I would think, blessed are the rich in spirit, right? Those who are spiritually fulfilled. But no, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And notice he doesn't say, blessed are the poor. Blessed are the poor in spirit. There's nothing blessed about being poor. I've been poor, I've been not considerably better. There's nothing poor, good about being poor. Blessed are the poor in spirit, in spirit. That is, those who recognize, no matter what their socioeconomic status, those who recognize the utter internal poverty of their own hearts, those who recognize the gaping hole in their heart that only God can fill, because you can't come one step closer to a Savior until you recognize your need to be saved. So blessed are the poor in spirit, those who recognize that gaping hole in their heart that nothing else can fill. That's the first step. For theirs is the kingdom of heaven. They're the ones who are on the path. That's where you start. There are nine statements that he'll make. Each one begins with, blessed is A, for they shall be B. Blessed is A, for they shall... It's a pattern. And there'll be nine of them. Eight with a concluding statement. So, We call them the Beatitudes because in Latin, in St. Jerome's translation of the Latin Vulgate, in Latin, the opening word is Beatus, hence the Beatitudes. But blessed are the poor in spirit, and they're not random statements. Each one builds on the one that came before, the ones that came before. So blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Again, it's a counterintuitive statement. I would think, blessed are the joyful. But no, blessed are those who mourn. Not primarily in the sense of bereavement, though that's certainly part of it, but those who understand and recognize their own internal poverty, and they mourn over the fact. You can recognize that internal poverty and say, oh, well, that's life. You know, we're born, we suffer, we die. That's the end of it. No, blessed are those who recognize that internal poverty and they are heartbroken because of it. They will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Well, that doesn't mean that you let somebody beat on you, you crawl up in a corner and don't do anything. That's not meekness, that's cowardice. When we look back at the Torah, and we watch Moses leading the people out of Egypt, and he gets all those people out into the wilderness, and they're out there for a whole generation, 40 years we read. And he has nothing but trouble with them. No sooner do they leave Egypt, you know, the 10 plagues, the parting of the Red Sea, they get to Mount Sinai. God gives them two great gifts, the law and the tabernacle. And then they're on the move and they start to whine and moan and complain. I hate this food. Back in Egypt, we had fish and melons and leeks and onions. Nothing but this stupid manna, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Manna this, manna that. Mrs. Moses wrote a cookbook, 101 Ways to Cook Manna. And hate this food. And are we there yet? I have to go to the bathroom. I've been leading tours a long time. I've heard it all, let me tell you. Well, now, Moses, he's out in the wilderness now, and his own brother, Aaron, and his sister, Miriam, start to complain. And they say, what, you think you're the big high muckety-muck around here? You're the only one God talks to? Look, we're older than you are. We're your brother and your sister. God talks to us too. Oh, they have a big blowout. And God finally steps in. And when you read that story in Numbers, now, traditionally, Moses is the author of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, the five books of Moses, the Torah. It's written in the voice of Moses. And right in the midst of the conflict with his brother and sister, parenthetically, we read, and it gains a new importance when you realize that Moses is the one writing it. And he says, now Moses was the meekest man who ever lived. It's Moses saying that about himself, right? Moses didn't crawl up in a corner and let people beat on him. He had quite the temper. He saw an Egyptian slave master beating a Hebrew. He was a prince of Egypt. He could have said, stop it, but he didn't. He killed him. No, Moses is one tough character. And he was the meekest man who ever lived. Meek means that you recognize your own internal poverty. You are brokenhearted over it. And as a result, you recognize that God is God and I'm not. That the proper position before God isn't to cozy up with him and put our arm around him. The proper position before God is flat on our face before him. Recognizing that he is God and you are not. That's genuine meekness in the face of God. And you only come to it by recognizing your own internal poverty and mourning over it. And then you're positionally in the proper place before God. For they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Those who desperately want to be seen as right before God. For they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. If indeed we recognize our own internal poverty, we are heartbroken over it. We have a proper position before God. We genuinely crave to be right in God's sight. Then we will also be merciful to others who are in the same position, even if they're not there yet. Because you know what it is to be apart from God. You know what it does to your own inner person. And you see someone else who doesn't recognize that yet, but it doesn't require judgment. Mother Teresa said, people who judge have no time for loving others. Recognizing that they are in as difficult a place as you are and being merciful toward them. And blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called sons of God. Well, one could think of political peacemaking, a Nobel Peace Prize, but I think it refers specifically, more particularly, to making peace with God. That is, stopping our rebellion. If we get to this place, we're in a position not only to be right with God, to bring peace between ourselves and God, peace in the fullest sense of the Hebrew word shalom, fulfillment on every level, but we're in a position to lead others there too. They will be called sons of God. And blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness. If you get to this place at statement number 7, peacemaker, you're going to be persecuted because the world doesn't like it. You know, the world, we read in Genesis that God created all that is and it was very good. And then sin enters the world. And we define sin not as an act that we commit, but a condition that we're in, a condition of alienation and separation from God. And the world is a fallen world. The world is in a condition of alienation and separation from God. The world is the Titanic. The church is the lifeboat. The Titanic has hit the iceberg. It's going down. And it's not our job to polish brass on the sinking ship or to move the furniture to a higher deck because it ain't wet up there yet. It's our job to get the people off the Titanic into the lifeboat. So if you see the world in that way, and you recognize the reality of sin, the holiness of God, and the inevitable judgment that must follow, that's the world. And your job is to get people into the lifeboat. And there will be severe opposition in the world. You will be persecuted. My goodness, they crucified the Lord. So, blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you, period. No, because of me. If it's for him. So rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the very same way, they persecuted the prophets who went before you. In the very same way. Notice, blessed is A, for they shall be B. Blessed is C, for they shall be D. Blessed is E, for they shall be F. You remember this stuff, and it's all counterintuitive, turned around. It is a really clever introduction. And then he follows it with two statements. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. Well, that's puzzling. How can salt lose its saltiness? Salt is salt, right? You are the salt of the earth. I always explain that by saying that, you know, what does salt do? Well, it makes you thirsty. That's why they put popcorn and peanuts out on the bar, so you order more beer. It makes you thirsty. Oh, we're to make people thirsty for God. Great. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? That doesn't fit. So what's the deal? I never understood this until very recently. We were in Egypt, and we were in transit to Mount Sinai in the Sinai. We right down by the southern tip of the Sinai Peninsula, and we climb Mount Sinai and watch the sun come up from the top of Mount Sinai in the morning. We head out at about midnight, and we get on camels, and we ride camels. How many have been with me on the Sinai? Vince has. We ride camels about two-thirds of the way up. Then it gets too steep and rocky, and you have to get off the camels and walk the rest of the way. But, we get to the top, and we watch the sun come up, and we sing, and we do all kind of things up there. And then back down we go. If you ride a camel, really, not like a pony ride in a circle, but if you really ride a camel, going up is really quite nice. Watch Lawrence of Arabia to learn how to do it. And you're on the camel. A horse bounces up and down. A camel goes back and forth. And if you kind of get the hip movement, it's really cool. Coming down, not so. Coming down, there are big steps going down. These are big animals, and you're in a saddle with a great big saddle horn, and the guys who ride the camels down are singing soprano at the bottom. It's not fun. Well, we did our Mount Sinai trip, and then we were transiting through the Negev, and I had arranged to stop at a Bedouin camp with real Bedouins, not actors, and real Bedouins, and we spent about a half a day with them learning about the Bedouin life, because so much of the Bible, the culture of the Bible, is rooted in the Bedouin culture. And so we were with them, and the women baked bread for us. And they dig a hole in the ground, maybe a foot deep and 18 inches, 2 feet wide, and then put twigs and things that'll burn in it and light it on fire. And the fire flares up and it burns. And then it's what looks like a wok upside down over top of it, a dome, heats up. And the women make, with flour and water and a little bit of oil, make the dough and kind of spin it like a pizza. And it's real thin. And then they throw it over the dome. And with a stick, they move it around so it doesn't stick. And lift it up, then flip it over and cook the other side and cook and flip it again. And then take it off, break it up, and they pass it out to us. It was really good. It was real good. And they made another one and a third one. And then we liked it. We ate it all up before it went around. So they were going to make a fourth one. But one of the women put the stick under the dome and looked. The fire had died down. So she had a little pouch sitting beside her. She reached in it and threw something in, and the fire went up again. What was that? It was salt. Salt from the Dead Sea. Remember the Dead Sea on our map? Lowest point on the face of the earth, 35% salt. The Pacific Ocean, 3.5%. Saltiest body of water on earth, and very rich in minerals, especially magnesium. And when the water evaporates and leaves the salt behind, it has a high magnesium content. They collect the salt, and when the fire goes down, toss it in. What happens to magnesium when it hits fire? It flares up. And they cooked another piece of bread on it. And then it was done. Well, I asked about it. We all did. Actually, we have a video of it on our website, on our video eye reports, the actual doing of it. And, what was that? And the man who was the Bedouin who was leading us said, well, that's salt from the Dead Sea. It makes the fire get hot. Oh. He said, you have to do that in an earthen oven. They simply refer to it as cooking bread in the earth. Oh, look. You are the salt of the earth. It refers to the salt from the Dead Sea thrown into the earthen oven to fire it back up again. That's what the salt of the earth is about. Who would have thought? Didn't find that out until about 5 years ago in the desert with the Bedouins. So you are the salt of the earth. Our job is to fire people up for God. Fire them up. And then he says, you are the light of the world. You are the light of the world. Here we are on the Mount of Beatitudes, over on the other side. It's a little hazy out. That's the Golan Heights over there. And we noted on our map, let me go back to it. Here we go. We noted on our map that on the Golan Heights side of the Sea of Galilee, notice the squares? These are the Decapolis cities. Deca is 10, Polis is city. There are 10 Greco-Roman cities on the east side, well, actually 9 on the east side, 1 on the west, Scythopolis. They're Greco-Roman cities, and they were lit up at night. If you were on the hillside of the Sea of Galilee, up on the Mount of Beatitudes, at night, or living along the shore, you could look across the lake and see the lights in the cities. They're as clear as day. You can even see them today. They're electric lights now, but it's all lit up over there. Jesus said, "You are the light of the world." And he gestures to the east side that everybody has seen the lights. He said, "A city on a hill cannot be hidden." It's exactly what he's looking at. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on a stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the very same way, let your light shine before men. We are walking through a dark, fallen world, and our job is not to become part of that world. Our job is to walk through it as ambassadors for Christ and to illuminate that world for everyone else. That's your job. You are the salt of the earth. Fire them up. You are the light of the world. And he brings his introduction to a conclusion. Nobody would ever forget this. Nobody. And how many times did he do a similar introduction? Well, over in Luke, this is the Sermon on the Mount. In Luke, he has the Sermon on the Plain. Different time, different place, different audience, and it's much shorter. How come? Well, I suspect that he did this one in the morning when everybody was fresh and it was nice out. Sermon on the Plain. It was 2 in the afternoon. You don't want that slot. And it was hot and people were tired. So he adapts to the audience, right? He adapts to the audience. He condenses it, makes it shorter, hits the major points, and is gone. There are 204 towns and villages in Galilee. I'll bet he did a version of the Sermon on the Mount about 204 times. This is a really good teaching. You don't just throw it away and put it in a drawer and get rid of it. So clever and memorable introduction. Statements that can be remembered because of the repetition of sound, consonant and vowel sound. 8 statements with a 9th concluding statement. Notice 9 statements and then 2 major points. Salt of the earth, light of the world. And that moves us into part 2. 6 propositions that exceed the law. Notice the symmetry of the teaching. It makes it easy to remember. We'll never forget the Beatitudes. We've read it 1,000 times, and now you see it in a different way. Imagine Jesus teaching this and watching him do it. This would be so cool. And remember John, who was there? And Peter, who was there, said, "We were eyewitnesses." I would love to have been there. I ran us about 5 minutes over our break. Take 10. Back we come, and we move into the 6 propositions that exceed the law, the 6 concrete actions to implement the law, and the call to action. Take 10.